ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Everybody, and welcome to our long-awaited holiday episode of Ticklish Business. Hopefully you've enjoyed the Patreon content that is now available for you to listen to, but we all know why you're really here, to hear us talk about Robert Mitchum in a Christmas film. Seems very weird to say, but as always, I'm Kristen Lopez, joined with my fantastic Ticklish Biz co-host, Drea Clark.
Hello!
And Samantha Ellis.
Hello.
We are talking about 1949's Holiday Affair, and I figured since it was a holiday affair, we should get the gang all together. This is actually the first time we've all recorded as one. How do we feel about this?
I'd say reunited and it feels so good, but like you said, there's no reunification. United and it feels so good.
I like that. I like that. The Ticklish Biz trio finally brought together for Christmas. But before we get into talking about Robert Mitchum and Janet Leigh and whether that kid is adorable or annoying, I want to talk about Christmas films. I want to talk about the classic Christmas films that you guys watch and hate. I did another podcast and we did a top five Christmas movies we don't like. And out of four of us, three of us, including myself, said, we did not like It's a Wonderful Life.
Ooh.
Wow, old. That's really surprising. I have only seen It's a Wonderful Life once, and it's not one of my favorites. It's funny that you mentioned It's a Wonderful Life because it's A Shop Around the Corner is my favorite. Everyone talking about It's a Wonderful Life, the other Jimmy Stewart Christmas film, it does get my goat a little bit because most of them have never discovered Shop Around the Corner, which is so good.
100% agree. Shop Around the Corner is so much more enjoyable. It's a Wonderful Life is one of those things that you can't avoid, which is probably something that adds to the kind of annoyance of it, but also you would miss it if it was gone. It's more treacly than sweet. There's always something about films with more of a forced messaging than a just organic sense that doesn't always sit well with me.
My problem with it is I saw it really late in life, and so I had grown up on other things referencing it. If anybody remembers in the 90s when they did a Rugrats episode where Chucky wished he was never born, they essentially remake It's a Wonderful Life. Well, I grew up on that, and so when I finally watched It's a Wonderful Life, I assumed the entire movie was about him wishing he was never born. Cut to finding out that that's actually like the last, what, 40 minutes of the movie, and the movie's like 2 hours, and I was just waiting, thinking, what is going on? How is this not happening? I rewatched It's a Wonderful Life again, divorcing it from what I had seen previously, and I really don't like the message. Stay at home, don't move, let your friends take advantage of you, and it all works out for you in the end.
As far as referencing it goes, the main reference that I remember as a child, I sort of had a similar experience as you in the sense that I heard about it long before I had seen it as an adult. But the main reference that I knew of was The Muppets.
Oh, with Michael Caine. No, I just conflated it with The Christmas Carol.
My boyfriend and I had the same conversation trying to distinguish the two. I only remember that one of the Muppets Christmas films had the plot of It's a Wonderful Life, and I did not remember which one.
It is a good point that it's been referenced. It's like the Rashomon of Frank Capra. It's utilized as a storytelling hook in so many things. Kristen, the point you made about when you finally saw the film and realizing that what you thought was the thesis of it, like the meat and bones, was actually not the entire movie. I would say half of the people that reference that movie don't remember the rest of it either.
There's a 2-hour movie there, and I don't think people really remember that a lot of that 2 hours is really just foundational. It's just exposition, setting up George Bailey's life and how he met everybody. Blame the Rugrats for why I don't like it. I am very weird when it comes to Christmas movies. The de facto classics, because hype really kills everything.
Yeah.
I think really ruin it for me. The Christmas classics that I enjoy are the stuff that nobody really would say is in their top three. I mean, maybe Meet Me in St. Louis, but I know Meet Me in St. Louis is a Christmas film in the sense that, like, The Sound of Music is a Christmas movie, as in it's just a general feeling like it should be Christmas, but it really doesn't have anything to do with Christmas.
I totally agree with you. The movie that I think of when I think of, oh, it should be one of my favorite Christmas films, but should I consider it a Christmas film, is Holiday Inn.
Yeah.
Because it's the same as Meet Me in St. Louis, where it only has a couple of Christmassy scenes and that one iconic Christmas song. But other than that, it has nothing to do with it. So I'm very much in the same boat.
I rewatched White Christmas. I went to the TCM Fathom Event screening. And I didn't really want to go because I don't like Bing Crosby and I don't like Danny Kaye. I went. I'm sorry. I know. I've already ruined. Dre already knows.
You heard the double gasp.
Dre already knows. Dick Powell and now Danny Kaye.
What is it with you and blonde all-American men? Van Johnson, oh, Dick Powell, Bing Crosby.
They just don't work for me in the classic era. I'm not understanding it, but I did like White Christmas this time around more than Holiday Inn, because Holiday Inn is racist as hell. And at least this movie was not
racist.
Maybe
they could put that on the reissue. At least this movie is not racist.
That's the title card before the title. This movie is not racist.
It does not include the Lincoln's birthday moment. If anybody's seen Holiday Inn, you know what I'm talking about.
You mean the minstrel show?
Yes. AKA the Abraham number, which my mom had never seen Holiday Inn, and I turned it on just because TCM was what we were watching while we were decorating the Christmas tree. And they start that scene, and I go to like find the remote, and my mom looks at it, and she's like, oh my god.
You so rarely get women in blackface. Isn't it just so refreshing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I think they had better sense. Yeah. Even then.
Exactly. Joan Crawford did Torch Song. That had blackface in color, so.
I only just found out about that. I did not know that she appeared in blackface until like this week when I saw the pictures.
I'm very happy that you now have that image in your head. What are some of our favorite Christmas movies? The ones that we definitely have to make time for. I throw out Christmas in Connecticut.
I love Absolutely. That movie so much.
We did an episode on it, I think, last Christmas with Lauren Humphreys Brooks, and it's so great. I actually watched the other day because they had it on demand on AMC. They had the 1992 remake, which I knew existed. And it stars Diane Cannon and Kris Kristofferson. And it's directed by that fine, fantastic auteur, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I was going to say it's the only thing Arnold Schwarzenegger ever directed.
Only film. He did direct an episode of Tales from the Crypt. But we watched it. My mom and I decided to watch it as kind of like a sick holiday joke because we figured, oh, at least we could make fun of it. And we sat there in stark silence the entire movie. I really want to interview Diane Cannon and just ask, because she's literally the best part. She gets that Barbara Stanwyck type of devil may care, irritated at all the men doing stuff. I really want to ask her, just why? Like, I want to know her thought process making this entire movie, because I was just so flummoxed that somebody obviously did not watch the original Christmas in Connecticut and then thought, hey, we should remake this.
They read the caption of what it's about and was like, oh, that sounds kooky. Let's do something kooky.
Yeah, let's have Tony Curtis play her boss.
Oh, that's right.
Slash the guy who really wants to be her husband and who sexually harasses her the entire movie. And I was just thinking, oh dear Lord. And Kris Kristofferson is essentially playing his character from A Star Is Born mixed with Arnold Schwarzenegger, because he's so He-Man ripping logs with his bare hands out in his Unabomber cabin.
Weird.
I know I mock Dennis Morgan. I mock him. But oh my god, I miss him. And he was still alive at this point when they made this movie. He could have literally played the guy who was the lover, and I would probably have liked it more.
I only found out about the remake just now.
Yeah, I found about it because we were tweeting about this, and I tweeted about Christmas in Connecticut, and Alonzo Duralde informed me that this Diane Cannon version existed, and I will happily never watch it.
Don't. It's,
I can't.
It's not even fun enough to make fun of. That's my problem. I will sit through something if I can at least make fun of it. And
sure.
There was no Christmas joy in this movie. It was 92. They took an old movie. They said they wanted to make some type of Home for the Holidays-esque film where everybody screams at each other and everybody has really over-the-top personality quirks. Only it's Christmas in Connecticut. I mean, I've watched a lot of the remakes because they love remaking holiday films from that time period. I will defend the 90s remake of Miracle on 34th Street to no end. This has no redeeming quality.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the joy of Christmas, because I do think the original Christmas in Connecticut has such a wonderful energy to it. But one of the reasons I do think people gravitate towards It's a Wonderful Life, even if those people are strangely not the three of us, there's an inherent sadness to it. I mean, the framing device is this man contemplating suicide. And I think a lot of people think of Christmas as, it's just an emotional time of year, not just joyful, but there's a sadness with it. Like,
right.
I mean, I think that suicide actually is a bigger problem over the holidays. Movies that have a little sadness to them at Christmas resonate with me. And so I count this as a movie, even though I know it's made for TV. But A Charlie Brown Christmas is always going to be a really special view for me. The animation of it, the music of it. It's just that stripped down, the loneliness about the holidays. I think there's that introspection of the end of the year. For the rest of the country, it's cold. I'm from Minnesota, so I may be in California now, but I remember the cold. So Charlie Brown Christmas, I would for sure put on my list of classic favorites.
I love A Charlie Brown Christmas because it is a bunch of 8-year-olds, one of whom is bemoaning the fact that Christmas is so commercial. And as a child, I was just like, Charlie Brown's kind of a jerk. He ruins everybody's holiday. And then as you grow older, that's how you know you're getting older and your childhood is like died, when you start identifying with Charlie Brown.
You're like, oh, that jerk really gets it.
Yeah, exactly. Samantha, what about you? What's the Christmas film that you always bring out?
As I said before, Shop Around the Corner is a perfect film to me. I always bring that one out, without a doubt. Not only is it a perfect Christmas film, it's probably in my top 10 favorite films. But aside from that one, my only real tradition since I started my own family is bringing out the animated Grinch from the 60s. I put it out every year as I decorate the tree. It's actually the perfect length, too, because right when we have the tree set up, I put it on, and by the time it's over, it's done. And it's just so wholesome and heartwarming, and I adore Boris Karloff. So it really pulls in that old Hollywood feel, and he couldn't be better in it. It's just fantastic. I know every word. The animation is great. The songs, it's just fantastic.
On another podcast I do, we did our top 5 favorite Christmas characters. I put Max from The Grinch. He is my favorite character of all time. Yes, the little dog. The Grinch's dog. I never fail to just identify, and I don't know what I identify with, but when he's sitting on the back of that sleigh and the Grinch realizes that there's no one pulling the sleigh and Max is on the back and he just shrugs his shoulders and waves. Yeah, that's me.
Nice.
But of course, we're talking about Holiday Affair for our holiday episode. We actually let the patrons decide this, and it was down to this and White Christmas. This won by a single vote, which might have been cast by one of the people sitting here right now. I'm not going to say who it was, Samantha, but I'm actually happy that we talked about Holiday Affair, because I feel it's a movie that is not talked about, and it should be, because if we're talking great holiday films that are also really weird. I think Holiday Affair is a prime example of old Hollywood filmmaking that blended the holidays with the bizarre. We discovered Lady on a Train last year, the Deanna Durbin Christmas noir mystery. I love that in the studio era, you could get really weird combinations of genres like that.
I haven't seen anything of Deanna Durbin's other than Three Smart Girls. That was the first one that I had seen. Seeing her as an adult, how beautiful she was, that is actually at the top of my list.
I love that you can get those weird genre crossovers. And this, it's not the weirdest genre crossover, but it's strange nonetheless. It tells the story of a comparison shopper, Connie Ennis, played by Janet Leigh. And a comparison shopper is essentially a corporate spy who goes to various stores and notes the prices of certain items and then calls their home store and then lets the home store know that they're being undersold or oversold. She ends up meeting Steve Mason, played by Robert Mitchum, who is a veteran and lovable drifter. Was there any other kind of hobo back in the day? The gunny sack, able to go from place to place. We call them homeless today, but they were just charming and roguish back in the day.
Very eccentric.
He was an eccentric. He ends up getting fired because he doesn't turn Connie in, and they end up having this little romance at the same time. Connie is a war widow with a small boy named Timmy, played by Gordon Gebert, who just wants a train for Christmas. All these characters come together in a romantic, weird drama that is both charming and just has some really bizarre moments in it.
This is actually the first time I've seen this. I don't know how it escaped me, because I love Janet Leigh so much and have very now conflicted thoughts on Robert Mitchum, who I enjoyed in such different films that it really took a minute for my brain. I look at him and I see Max Cady from Cape Fear. So I was like, oh, do not let that man know where you live. Why are you letting him come home with you? Then I realized the miracle of movies, and then it wasn't the same person. It did my head in when it started. I was like, oh, yes, I know how this is going to be. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, nope. Oh, no, she's in another oh, there's love? What is happening? The timeline of it. I was like, is this just a couple of days? I don't know. I'm someone who I adore a romantic movie, but almost every romantic movie I'm like, nah, I think I need about 2 to 3 more scenes of why these people are interested in each other, especially to this degree. I will say, going back to the beginning, I loved Timmy, the son. I was so impressed by that kid's performance, because kids are terrible performers in most cases. And he had so much dialogue. He had a lot of heavy lifting to do. And I found his inquisitiveness with the train. Anyway, I really liked he and Janet Leigh's rapport. I believed them.
Samantha, what about you? What was your background to this prior to, and what did you think of it?
This is the single holiday film that I always hear about. Everyone has seen it since it's been shown on TCM every year. And I knew that I had to see it this year. And, you know, giving the option for fans to vote, I couldn't resist breaking the tie. This was the first time that I saw this movie, and I loved it. It's one of those things where every single actor, I mean, both Janet Leigh and Robert Mitchum, I hadn't seen them in a whole lot, aside from, you know, the classics like Night of the Hunter with Mitchum and Psycho with Janet Leigh. And it was so great seeing them young and together. It was such an interesting pairing that I couldn't get enough of.
This is a movie I watch every year. I've been watching this for several holidays now. I can't remember exactly why I watched it. I think it might have had to do with Robert Mitchum just wanting to know what he looked like in a holiday drama like this.
Yeah,
I think everyone's curious about that.
And I really, really enjoy this movie. This is Robert Mitchum. I wouldn't say it his swooniest, but if you want to see him do something different and still be romantic as can be, I mean, this works. This gets it done. And Janet Leigh, I feel, is a real unsung talent between this and something like Little Women. she is just so good at playing the down-to-earth average woman. I mean, she's beautiful. She's gorgeous. But there is this earthiness to her. She's not untouchable. She's not pristine. You see her living in this lower middle class type of environment with her son. There's this concept of, and we all look at subtext when we look at classic film, but this is a woman that you know has obviously had sex because she has a child. So there's not that pristine quality to her. And I hate that we have to say that because that's how women have been presented. But she's a woman that is not chastised for having two men going after her. It's really unique for this time period. She's a woman that's lived life. And I love that about her character. And I also like the fact that there are two guys that are just good guys in this movie. There's not the 90s rom-com conceit of one guy's obviously cheating on her or something, or he's abusive. Robert Mitchum and Wendell Corey, who plays Carl, they're just good guys. You'd probably be okay with her ending up with either. Of course, she's going to end up with the A-list actor, but you could conceivably understand her interest and what she sees in both of these guys, which I don't think you often see in romantic comedies, even of this era.
I kept expecting the Carl, the lawyer boyfriend, to reveal himself to be a heel of some sort, to belittle her or to just be inappropriate with her in some way. And he's so decent throughout that it adds even more sort of complexity. The idea that this holiday movie is taking on, to me, and it's why I wanted a couple more scenes, because I think it's such a delicious idea, the concept of true love or exciting love or something magical, because they do have a nice relationship and they're comfortable with each other. And something else that you mentioned, the idea of the respect that Janet Leigh's character gets is great. That we meet her and she's a hard worker and she's upfront about it. There can often be tangled with the gender politics, that economic idea of, oh, she needs to get married to support her son or something. And I like that that's removed. She's a widow. She's taking care of it. She has this boyfriend, partner, whatever, who is doing well, but that doesn't enter into it. And I was really grateful for it.
Well, I also really appreciate the fact that this movie, it's something you really don't even see in modern movies today. There is this discussion about raising children. There's a scene where you really get the dynamic between Carl and Connie when Timmy realizes that Carl and his mother are going to get married and he really likes Steve and he acts out. And Carl goes to discipline him and Connie says, take your hands off my boy. Instead of having this big argument about it, the two of them actually later have a conversation where Carl says, if that's the relationship that we're going to have, where he's your son and he's not mine, that's not really what I want, but I understand it. And if you're willing to go into this with me, then I want him to be our son and I'm going to discipline him and love him, help make decisions for him. But they actually talk about the boundaries of being a boyfriend to a woman with a child. And I really respected the characters and I respected Isabel Leonard, who is the screenwriter, for actually writing a scene where these two characters are going to discuss what the boundaries of their relationship are going to be. Because with the war ending, there were so many women who, quote unquote, had baggage, had children. Where are the lines drawn if they want to date? They should be able to go out and have relationships, but they also have this child. Where are those lines drawn? So I really respected the movie for even bothering to include something like that.
I mean, that's a rarity now.
I feel a little bit differently than you guys. I completely agree that I admire this movie so much because it gives a really great view of the reality of post-World War II families. Connie's struggle with her son, it was so common and largely underrepresented in film at this point, along with Carl's relationship with her son. Ben Mankiewicz, when he mentioned Carl in his introduction for this film earlier this month, the one that I caught, he said that he felt sorry for Carl, and I couldn't disagree more. I think it might be partially because he always looks angry or annoyed in the film, But after seeing his actions and his remarks, it's really a no-brainer to me that Steve would have made a better father even if he didn't know her as well. I can't imagine Connie and Carl working out if they got married, especially with all of these arguments. But I get a sort of entitled vibe from Carl. Like, he feels that he deserves Connie only because he's wanted her for so long.
The reason that I came around to him, and I was expecting something just egregious, and I don't know why, because it's called a holiday affair, so obviously it's not going to be something so ugly. His handling of the disillusion of their relationship, I was like, all right, Carl, way to pick up on it. Because you're right, I don't think that they would have been necessarily happy together, but I do think that he and Connie would have been fine. It would have been a relatively loveless and by-the-books partnership versus falling in love and finding someone and having something more romantic and swoony, which is obviously the Mitchum of it all. But I did like that Carl's final nod was picking up on that Connie had these strong feelings. Because typically characters like Carl, who are entitled and kind of like, all right, I've put in the work, so now I want my reward, aren't the people who are going to be astute enough to read the subtext of her not being able to face this man again and knowing, oh, it's because she has strong feelings for him, not just out of respect for me.
Exactly.
I also really like that you have Carl realize that he's lost, and he is very gracious about it. But I appreciated too that the movie does not give him a consolation prize.
Yeah.
There's not another woman in this movie that you can conceivably say, oh, they'll end up together, as this apology that he still deserves a woman.
That is a fantastic point.
That is a testament to Isabel Leonard, who wrote the script. It's rare to see female writer directors in any capacity before the 70s. And Isabel Leonard was actually relatively successful screenwriter, predominantly in the 40s. She did the original screenplay for Lost Angel. She did the screenplay for Anchors Away, East Side, West Side, the Lana Turner movie, A Life of Her Own. She did a lot of these movies where it was women in the forefront, and there's really subtle things that are going on. She ended, her last film was the screenplay for Funny Girl, which it would be great to really look at all of her screenplays and really look at the feminism of them, because there's some subtlety in there. Carl is, it's Wendell Corey, so, you know, he's just the Ralph Bellamy, I think, of this film. Perpetual lovable loser. Have to disagree a little bit with Samantha, because I feel like Steve kind of oversteps his boundaries a little bit.
That's true. I can't deny that.
And I mean, I say that as I love Robert Mitchum. Robert Mitchum is, I would not go back in time when I get my time machine started. He's not going to be the first stop I make.
But he'll be
exactly.
There.
Exactly. I will make a stop at some point, but I'm going to find John Garfield first, and that's going to be my first stop. But Robert Mitchum will be there at some point. I definitely love the fact that he's in this. This was an apology to fans. The year before, he had been busted with two women smoking pot and was arrested for drugs and had been sentenced to some prison time for possession. And people assumed his career was going to be over. But Howard Hughes, because he was a He-Man and loved big macho actors, really kept him on and refused to drop his contract at RKO. They paid $400,000 to acquire Robert Mitchum's contract from Selznick, who had shared it with RKO, and they actually bought Selznick out to keep Robert Mitchum, and they gave him this movie. A lot of people said this was essentially a safe role to make people forget that he had been busted for drugs. There is a fun and a whimsy. When you first meet Steve, he's teaching the little kids how to play with the train, and Connie shows up and he's like, oh, well, this man was here first. You know, he might be a willing customer. You don't really know.
Yeah.
He doesn't look down on the children, which I think is really sweet. But then when he's with Connie, there is this almost oppressive alpha male sexual potency type of thing to him, where he's just oozing sexuality on her. We gotta talk about his proposal in a second, but I was just sitting there thinking, this movie is really flirting with being on the lines of, like, I feel like Janet should probably call somebody. I'm feeling she might want to make a phone call.
My worry about who she should be calling was less directed to her. So we're introduced to him concentrating on the kids and showing them the toys or the train. You're like, oh, good. So it's a man who likes children. But then I was like, wait, is this a capital letter man who likes children? Because then I do not know any time that I found I was more incredulous watching something than this woman brings this man home from the department store and is like, cool, cool. Please go hang out with my son in his room alone with the door shut. Take your time. I'll be in the kitchen. That, I was like, he could fly out of here. He could sprout wings and fly, and I would believe it more than that solo moment. I was like, no, open the door. What is going on?
This is one of those movies, I said it in the beginning, that could only exist in the classic film era when you could bring back a lovable homeless man and have him play with your child and not find it threatening at all. That's why these are movies. That's why movie magic is a term to explain how this could happen. And he is the cleanest bum. I say bum. He has a house. He's staying at like kind of a hotel apartment type of deal. But he has no real ties to anything. That's really where I was a little taken aback, because where the movie gives us time between Connie and Carl to talk about the mechanics, the unsexy stuff about their relationship, her and Steve don't have those conversations. You know, she never stops to ask him, okay, so are we going to live with me? Where are we going to live? You know, you don't have a job. Going out at the end of the movie to go seek his fortune. But having just watched Saturday's Children the other day, which is a John Garfield and Anne Shirley movie, which we just talked about Anne Shirley, and I feel like that would have been a great excuse to get a John Garfield movie in there. But watching that movie where it's like two young people who don't have great jobs trying to make it in a harsh city, I was just sitting there thinking, that poor Connie is going to be working double time to take care of him.
The chemistry between them and how he's laying it on, like their spark, accounts for so much. But you're so right. The juxtaposition between how much time and attention is spent with Carl talking about this is how it works and you come here and this is how it'll be, and the absolute unknowingness, that is exactly why I was like, I think I need a couple more scenes with these people, and I'm happy to lead us into that proposal, because I was like, just wait, this man who is like, don't even tie me down with an apartment, sign me up for that woman and her kid. That was another big leap for me.
The proposal is just so, I'm going to use the term ballsy. You know, you could only do this if you were an entitled guy. It's Connie and Carl and her parents and Timmy, and they invite Steve over for dinner. His last day, he's going to go off and drift somewhere else. Carl and Connie announce that they're going to get together, and everybody's really happy. And Robert Mitchum stands up, all swagger. There's no humility to it at all. And he just says, Connie, Carl's really nice and all. And I know we just met an hour ago, but I think you should marry me. And here's why. Where I lost it, and I just kind of was like, oh God, is when he says, in a manner of speaking, he says, we could beat around the bush about this, and I could do it right, take you out on a date. And he says, or Carl, would you rather find me trying to get Connie behind the kitchen stove? And I was just like, oh no. Her parents are sitting right there, guy.
Her parents, whose reaction is, oh, maybe we should leave the room. What? you know for a fact she just met him and they just bailed him out of jail. You should have a louder reaction, parents.
The proposal is actually my favorite part. On the point of the parents, I think that's very interesting because the parents like him right off the bat. Even knowing everything that they know, it's a little bit justified. This is one of those movies, I feel like when there's always a love triangle, it's a very common frame. You have the woman and you have the boring guy that she's already with. And then there's the interesting that guy that comes in and shakes things up. And this is very much the plot of this film. And the parents are so on board with this other guy. I mean, he's already gotten the son some trains. He's just good in their book. Their speech about how, you know, they were so good together and everything, and how they're, when they heard that she was getting married to Carl instead of Steve, they're like, are you sure? I shipped them already by that point. By the end of the film, I was a little bit sick of the on again, off again between Connie and Steve. And I would have loved to see her realize her feelings for Steve at the proposal scene. I think that would have been really clever.
This movie's barely 90 minutes. It just skirts 90 minutes. It's an hour 27. And I feel like a lot of what Steve is brought in for is hijinks. They have these little moments where they talk in front of the seals. That's where he goes to feed the seals. And then he gives a gift to a homeless man who in turn steals a gift for him in recompense and gives it to a little girl, which I actually really dig the little girl who's seen steals from the two yes. A-list actors when he says, hey, shouldn't you have ice skates? And she says, no, I got roller skates. And she tells her friend, hey, Tina, look at the roller skates I got. That's really, really funny. But then it culminates with him getting arrested and then Carl and Connie having to bail him out of jail.
The Harry Morgan performance as that beleaguered police officer was a highlight for me. You know, I'm a big fan of the brief appearance, and he was giving so much character to that character. I got a whole feeling from him. I love good actors.
But there's a lot of hijinks that I think really are there to pad the runtime. By the time the proposal just happens, oh my gosh, it's incredibly wonky. And I say this as a person who, again, loves this movie. And I understand that we're critiquing things that are movie magic, that are the fantasy of old Hollywood. But I feel like Mitchum has a hard time getting out of that noirish, hard scrabble character. And so a lot of his arguments with Connie seem like low blows. He keeps talking about how, really, this is about you being hung up on your dead husband. It has nothing to do with anything else. I'm going to analyze you. I've only known you a couple hours, but we all know that your hesitancy has to do with the fact that your husband is dead. And if I marry you, then you need to put that old husband in your rear view and get with me. I was just thinking, he brings it up a lot. And it felt like if this was a different tone, only slightly, this would be gaslight.
I found that more entitled than Carl's handling of their relationship or of how he would be. It's tricky because Mitchum is so charming and is such a clear breath of fresh air to her life. On a story level, you appreciate that idea of, oh, someone who sees deeper into her and who's calling out her tendencies and looking at the roots. But it doesn't necessarily seem that healthy, what he's pointing out or how he's approaching it.
He's sort of correct, and I don't think she would have noticed it if it weren't for him pointing it out. But on the other hand, it is the film version of God modding. He assumes all these things that just happen yes. to be correct about her without him supposed to be knowing about it as yes. far as what he really knows about her in the film. But as far as the quirks and the padding of the runtime, we all know that this movie would be nothing without Robert Mitchum. He brings yes. everything that is interesting to the film. It would be completely 100% boring without him. But I'm really fascinated by how different this role is for Mitchum. He fits so easily as a tough guy in noirs, but I actually prefer this part, seeing him stretch the limits of his talents like this. And my other favorite role of his would be in The Locket, which is also a noir, but he has a much more lighthearted part in it.
I do love the marketing of this movie. This was not a box office hit. This and It's a Wonderful Life were actually two very well-known RKO holiday failures that went on to become classics because they played a lot on television. They released this movie with the marketing of Janet Leigh in kind of like a cheesecake pose with Robert Mitchum in the corner being like, baby, I want you for Christmas, drawing from Out of the Past. They actually went back and reconfigured the marketing to try to make some money, because it was Howard Hughes, and actually started to sell this as a noir, with the emphasis on the affair and moving away from the holiday. And so the poster for this ended up showing Robert Mitchum grabbing Janet Leigh's arm with the tagline, "It happens in December, but it's hotter than July."
What?
Yeah, you can actually go to Wiki and see this poster. It is hilarious.
I love that poster. I was going to bring up that point too. And what's really interesting is that image stuck and just really latched onto this movie throughout history. It led to people considering it the only Christmas noir, even though that couldn't be farther from the truth. I had heard that and even believed that it was the case until someone recently, before I saw the film, explained the situation to me. So it's amazing how just one poster, one tagline can change the entire perception of a film for so long.
It's actually really hilarious. And Robert Mitchum was one of those, came with his own cachet. If you've read any of the stories about working with actresses specifically, when he did Rachel and the Stranger with Loretta Young, Loretta Young actually had a swear jar because she was very, very conservative. And so Robert Mitchum actually, I think, gave her like $100 or something. It might have been $5. I don't remember the exact amount. But pretty much said this is going to cover filming. He wasn't even going to hide the fact that he was probably going to curse in front of her. This is probably my favorite Ben Mankiewicz story, if anybody's ever heard it, they showed it on TCM. I pretty much refer to Robert Mitchum in this way all the time. But Ben Mankiewicz told a story when he introduced this, I think, last year, about how when you watch actors kiss, it's a very, very formalized way of kissing, in classic film at least. Very closed mouth, mashing your lips together. There is like no actual contact for the most part, nothing romantic. And that the first time him and Janet Leigh had a kiss, he actually kissed her for real, which Ben Mankiewicz referred to as giving her the Bob Mitchum treatment. And I was just like, yep, I'm going to start saying that all the time now. So every time there is a Robert Mitchum movie in my house, I say it's the Bob Mitchum treatment. I think they ended up refilming the scene for the eventual film, so it's not in this movie, but I thought that was really funny.
The introduction by Ben that was shown earlier this month, they said that that take was in the film.
Oh, okay. So yeah, I wasn't sure.
Look on Janet Leigh's face with that real, real kiss. I'm going to use that as a pickup line for my boyfriend.
Exactly, yeah, the Bob Mitchum treatment. Do it.
If you come home early, you'll get the Bob Mitchum treatment.
Exactly, yes. It's going to be the new thing. I'm going to put that on the bumper sticker. We haven't talked about little Gordon Gebert as Timmy Ennis. Gordon Gebert is still with us. I know a friend, shout out to Jessica Pickens, who does Comet Over Hollywood. She actually interviewed him recently when they showed this. Dre, you brought up child actors, and I know I've brought up child actors being very, very hit and miss, especially in classic film. Gordon Gebert had 35 credits to his name before he retired in 1960. He did this. He was also in The Narrow Margin, The House on Telegraph Hill, Flame in the Arrow. This was actually his second movie, first credited film. He had appeared in Come to the Stable, which is another feature Christmas movie we might do at some point. But this was his first credited film. And I definitely think he's very adorable. He's very precocious. He's not an adult in a child's body, the Dakota Fanning principle, right, as I call it, where it's just, a grown adult shrunk down to kid size. He is a child. I do like that the movie hints at the concept of his mother working for a department store, but his mother is very sensible. It's not in the sense of like Maureen O'Hara in Miracle on 34th Street, where she's just like, magic doesn't exist, stop believing in Santa, where she is overly practical. But Connie wants Timmy to be realistic, and so she doesn't buy him crazy Christmas gifts. He says something, my teacher says that we should believe in the impossible. She's just like, I wouldn't listen to everything your teacher says. You should maybe come back down to earth a little bit. She wants him to be logical because life and death exist, I think is kind of what they allude to. By the end, when he's just like, I like Steve, Carl's fine, but I like this guy that you brought home. I just find him to be a little, like, too much of the, if you aren't on board with Robert Mitchum, he is the surrogate for you to be like, see, you should really like this guy. You really should.
Oh, yeah.
That is so realistic for children. Not only do I love his performance, I think he's a fantastic child actor. The kid couldn't be nicer, the character. I watch so many movies and I have such a low tolerance for children in film. That's why I don't really care for To Kill a Mockingbird outside of the courtroom scenes. So when a kid does something that a normal kid would do, I tend to get annoyed. But he is one of my favorite child characters that I've seen in classic film, because every move that he makes is normal and it's good, and he's just a really sweet child.
Not to be such a Timmy stan, and I keep talking about him because I definitely did already.
I'm a Timmy stan.
You're there. Good. We're all Timmy stans together. Directing kids is very hard because they tend to learn their line readings a particular way and they parrot it back. They'll say it how they say it when they're learning them so they can memorize things. And when they're off book, like, it's very hard to shake them from that delivery. And so that's why a lot of kids in films, especially anything where you're not taking the time to shoot a bunch of takes with them, which when are you, it can have that rote and rehearsed feel. And actually, when we watched Kristen, what did we watch with my buddy Shirley Temple? And it was her as a teen.
Oh, Since You Went Away.
Yes, Since You Went Away with Claudette Colbert. That's how they learn how to act. And so it grows with them. The fact that this is his first film is pretty impressive because he doesn't have those mannerisms of the heavy rehearsals. And like I said, there's a lot on him. There's a lot of just, all right, we need you to shuffle from this room to this room. And while you're doing that, convey an impish disappointment. And I think he does a really lovely job. He's definitely the built-in litmus of, this is how you're supposed to feel about Carl, and this is how you're supposed to feel about Steve, is via Timmy's reaction.
That's so true.
But having one real purpose, he does that well.
Gordon Gebbert is actually pretty good in this movie. Maybe it's just me. I'm not big on kids in general, so not everybody's Margaret O'Brien. My gold standard for child actors. But here, I do like the conclusion, the climax, when he takes the train back to the department store and he goes from A to B and really just thinks that what is going on boils down to a train. And it does, but it also doesn't. But I love that his child mind thinks that if he just returns this train, everything will go back to the way it was. And I do find it really funny in almost like a Home Alone type of way when he's going into this department store and one person's like, are you alone? And he's like, no. And then he gets to the elevator and somebody steps on his train and he gets out and this guy lasciviously says, you're alone. Like he's going to call the police or something.
Right? Timmy is preyed on men throughout this film. Can we discuss what's the opposite of a deus ex machina of Mr. Crowley, the department store owner?
Oh, that's so true.
That I was truly like, ooh, it's a Christmas film, so I can't wait for this guy to A, have magical powers of some sort, B, decide to give Timmy, you know what, you don't need that train, but let me fill that box with cash. Something that this kid's done this big journey, because his main job in this movie is just to convey how we feel about people. And right now, we're very sad about Steve. But then he does this whole journey. He makes it. He gets to the top. He gets to talk tearfully to the store owner. And then he takes a cab home. Like, it was very
unexpected. That's a very good point. Because he does all of this. He goes all the way up. And he essentially ends up telling Crowley his life story. Or at least his story of Connie's whole relationship with Steve and Carl. What it seems like. He just gives him the whole backstory. He's not going to solve the problem. He's not going to do this or that. He just gives him a refund. And I think that's hilarious.
Right? It's so real life that this mom is like, you know what? You can have toys that we can afford and rich people aren't going to fix things. That's the world we live in.
I love how Timmy comes home and he's just like, oh, I'm going to go to bed now. I know I'm in trouble. He just gives up. Then it all culminates with New Year's Eve. And Connie is sitting there and he says, oh, Mom, once I get married and move, you're going to be all alone.
Oh, my goodness, right?
And I was just like, oh, God, kid, you're really laying it on thick. I love that final scene. It's all wordless. And they go to the train and you see the filming through the different cars. And it ends with them finally finding Steve and having this big New Year's Eve reunion.
It's the best shot part of the movie.
It is.
It's the only visually interesting thing, which is fine. I mean, this isn't that kind of movie, but it's unique. It made me definitely want to go to a New Year's Eve party on a train.
Yes. We need to obviously rent a train and do that because it sounds fun.
Yeah, I'll call my buddy Mr. Crowley and get some money for us to rent a train.
No, he'll just give you a refund.
That's true. He won't give me the money.
You'll have to tell him his whole backstory and he'll just give you a refund.
Yes.
We haven't talked about this movie. It's directed by Don Hartman, who is better known as a screenwriter. He wrote several scripts throughout the 1940s. He ended up dying relatively young in 1958. He wrote a lot of scripts, predominantly for rom-coms and musicals. He did The Gay Deception, Champagne Waltz, Waikiki Wedding, Life with Henry, My Favorite Blonde, Road to Morocco, Princess and the Pirate. He did a lot of Danny Kaye films, but he only directed 5 movies. This was his third. He started out in 1947 with the Ginger Rogers film, It Had to Be You. Then he did Every Girl Should Be Married with Cary Grant. Then he did this. He closed out with the 1951 films Mr. Imperium and It's a Big Country, an American Anthology. So not a huge career, but he does well, I think, with this movie. This is a film, I think, if you know the background, I think makes it even better because, you know, Mitchum was there because he was trying to soften his image. Janet Leigh was like super unhappy having to make this movie. She did not like working with Howard Hughes. Howard Hughes was one of those who probably would have been brought up on Me Too charges if he had been working today. Was well known for trying to get into relationships with his leading ladies and actually had Janet Leigh investigated. And she had to tell him that if he wanted her to keep working, that he would have to maintain a professional relationship with her. But in the end, I mean, it all looks really good in the finished product, that it's amazing that it was a very contentious set.
It counts on the dialogue and the script so much that it's no wonder that a screenwriter was hired to direct in that sort of a rare instance. It relies on it so much that the actual directing wasn't as necessary, but somehow you get this magical performance from this kid and from the leads.
Overall, what do we all think about this? I consider this a Christmas classic. Yes, it has flaws, but it's Robert Mitchum in a Christmas film. Like, I can't stress the awesomeness of that enough. And I really do like Janet Leigh. I've liked her in everything I've seen her in. She's great in this, even though she was only 14 years older than the child playing her son. I still think she's very, very good. And it's a unique Christmas film. Actually, I think stops to have conversations about relationships that you don't see. It's the benefits of having a woman writing. You really, really see the benefits of having different voices writing these films. So I enjoy this a lot. Drea, what do you take away from Holiday Affair? What do you think about it?
I'm happy to have finally watched it. My overriding feeling is one of Christmas joy, you guys. Just miracles and tinsel. I definitely liked it. I liked that seeing another side of Robert Mitchum, even if he was coerced into doing this for PR purposes. I love Janet Leigh. I liked the shape of it, and I liked the fact that the Christmas magic in this was just in the absolute rush through their relationship, through every stage of a relationship in 2 days, which is a Christmas miracle in itself. I would watch it again with family and Coco.
Samantha, what about you?
I am so glad that I discovered this film with you both. I love these kind of relationship. Jeremy Arnold, who was introducing the film with Van Mankiewicz this year for his publishing his book, it's fantastic that he brought to my attention how the classic Christmas movies that remain in our minds through history are about these complicated relationships between families during the holidays. And this couldn't be a better example of that. And I'm so glad that TCM is really the entity that made it the classic that it is. I hope that it becomes TCM's It's a Wonderful Life.
That would be lovely.
It's so good. I'm very happy the Christmas films they've chosen this year on TCM have been awesome. I got to interview Jeremy about his book, and it was great just hearing about the different weird films that I did not know are out there. Definitely check out his book and the Christmas films. If you have TCM on demand, definitely watch all of them. Obviously, if you have thoughts on Holiday Fair, if you love It's a Wonderful Life and you think I'm wrong, you can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com and we will read them on a future episode. But that's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a variety of different ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, Stitcher Radio, Player FM, wherever podcasts are, or on iTunes. If you're listening via iTunes, please consider helping out the podcast with a rating and a review. As always, you can contact us directly with questions, comments, suggestions at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com. Or you can visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. And the podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. If you want to follow me personally on Twitter, I'm on Twitter at journeys_film. Drea, where can fans find and get in touch with you? What's going on with your career, all of that?
I'm on Twitter at the Drea Clark, which is ridiculous, but reality. Currently working on the Golden Globes, so surrounded by a whole new breed of film stars and yes. TV stars.
Samantha, yeah. What about you? Where can fans read your work? What's going on with your site? Where are you online?
Well, first, you can reach me on Twitter. I'm at Classic Film Geek. I would love to hear your thoughts on this movie and discuss this one with the fans. My blog is musingsofaclassicfilmaddict.com. I recently bought the site name, so I dropped the WordPress, so you can reach me there too.
If you want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else, then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. We have a wealth of amazing perks. All your donations go straight back into making the show the podcast that it is. And if you become a patron right now, you can listen to way more than what you probably have been listening to the last couple of weeks. In lieu of a hiatus, I shared the first pilot episode of Doubled Features, the podcast I do with Adam Kautzer, where we look at films that Hollywood loves again and again. Hopefully you enjoyed our episode that I shared with everybody on The Blob, 1958 versus 1988. We also have our episode on The Bad Seed, which you can listen to on Patreon now. And we're getting ready to record our next episode, which will come out in January. We're going to be looking at the dueling versions of Lolita. It's going to be a very weird episode to film.
Very excited for that.
Oh, yeah. I actually enjoy one of those movies a lot. It's going to be very, very awkward. And I'll let you all think of which version I like. Also, if you listened, I put out my episode of Based on a True Podcast, the podcast that I do on Patreon with William Bibbiani, where we talk about the movies when Hollywood talks about itself. You can actually go on patreon.com right now and listen to our latest episode where we talked about Jennifer Love Hewitt playing Audrey Hepburn in the 2000 film The Audrey Hepburn Story. So if you enjoyed our episode that we did on Hollywoodland, you can go over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz and listen to all the episodes we've done in that series, as well as previous interviews that I've done with Alan K. Rohde and a bunch of other things are going to be coming up on Patreon in the coming months. And if you're interested in hearing more about the stars turning 100 this year, I closed out the first volume of the TCM Backlot Centennial Celebration series I've been covering all year. I talk about the stars that we've spotlighted this year, and I talk about information and films that you won't hear on the show. Centennial Celebration is not going to be happening next year on the podcast. We decided to spread the love to other actors next year, but I will be continuing the series over at TCM Backlot. So if you are a member, you can keep up on all the stars that are turning 100 in 2019. But that's going to close out this episode. We will be back in January with a whole new year of episodes. And honestly, ladies, before we close it out, I want to say I'm very happy that we are going to be taking Ticklish Biz into 2019 as a trio, talking about some hopefully amazing movies and actors and all of that.
Yay, me too.
Same. I cannot wait to discuss our favorites of 2018.
That's right. So since...
And Jeff Chandler.
Yes. Samantha gave away the cat out of the bag, which I'm fine with that. No, it's totally fine. But we will be back in January. We're going to do our final centennial celebrant. We did not have time to get them celebrated in December. We're going to be talking about Jeff Chandler. All three of us will be back to talk about our top five favorite classic film discoveries of 2018. So until then, have a great holiday. Merry Christmas if you celebrate, and a great, happy, safe new year. We will be back next time. Bye.